Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Welcome in, everyone, and happy St. Patrick's Day. You've been hearing it all day. We're at the tail end of it. It's an interesting day. Very, very interesting day. Do we know that 13 million pints of Guinness will be consumed all over the world today? Do we know that Rob Lowe, the actor, was born on St. Patrick's Day? And on the other side of the spectrum, John Wayne Gacy, killer of 33 boys from the Chicago area, was also born on St. Patrick's Day. And you know, one of the most interesting things about St. Patrick's Day in Chicago is the dyeing the river green and all that stuff, which is really neat. But originally, and you may know this, originally city pollution control workers used to use dyes to trace illegal sewage discharges. And someone had the idea that it would be fun to use a dye like that and dye the river green. So that's basically how they do it. So, you know, it's an interesting day. And I used to have a professor where I went to law school who really hated St. Patrick's Day, and he found it offensive that people celebrated the Irish with drinking and getting out of control and all that stuff. I don't know if any of you feel the same way. I don't, but you know, I just think that any holiday, any something that celebrates your heritage, whether it's Cinco de Mayo or an Italian holiday, any day that celebrates someone's heritage, I think is a good thing. And overdoing it is always part of a celebration, I suppose. One of the topics this week, you know, really fascinating story. I don't know if you were drawn in like I was with this university scandal. And I know we've talked a lot about it this week, but I'm going to take a slightly different tactic. I have an author coming on who talks about helicopter parenting, and she's going to talk about basically how she kind of predicted the kind of thing that happened. Not exactly, of course, but that parents are so hell-bent on getting their kids into the school that they want their kids to get into that they ignore what their children might want. And in this point, in this case, basically ignore the law and getting into serious legal trouble because of it. But this is just part and parcel of how parents, and some parents, are overparenting and overprotecting and overdefending their children and inserting checklists into everything that children are supposed to be doing, to the point where they're just not functioning very well on their own when they get to the point where they have to do that. So at 7:30, we'll be talking to Julie Lithcott Hames, author of the book How to Raise an Adult. Very interesting. She's a very interesting woman. But in this time period before 7:30, I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this story and some of the issues and some of the aspects I would like to ask you. As a practicing lawyer, I see these lawsuits that are being brought. The kids are and the parents are suing the school, saying we didn't really have a fair chance of getting in because of all the fraud that was going on. Certainly, the participants are going to be sued by the colleges, by the applicants, to say you guys defrauded us out of our fair chance. You know, they're interesting lawsuits. There's some legal problems with them. You'd have to prove that your kid would have gotten in but for the fraudulent applicants. And you'd also have to prove damages, that your kid went to Brown instead of Harvard, and as a result, he had a worse education and he didn't get the job that he should have gotten, and here are the damages resulting from that. Kind of a stretch. But certainly those suits will be brought. They have been brought, and the class actions will probably trail us for the next 4 or 5 years. And watch what the universities do to prevent this kind of thing. There's going to be all kinds of precautions taken, and we will see laws passed criminalizing this conduct in any way, shape, or form to punish people and to prevent this from happening. But some of the things that I'd like to hear from you listeners, 981-7200, who's the most culpable in this piece? Okay, is it the schools for allowing this to happen? Is it the proctors who are faking the tests and doing that part? Is it the parents who are wealthy and will do anything to make their kids succeed in the view that they have of success? Or is it the mastermind, the guy who put all this together and made $25 million allegedly by taking the money and putting this whole scam together? Who's the most culpable? Who should spend more time in jail? Who should spend time in jail? Should this be something that a person spends a year in jail? What do you think? What kind of sentence would you give a parent who maybe you could argue is acting in their very best interest to try to get their kid in school, but in so doing violated the law and basically engaged in a bribery scheme, right? So, you know, those are the kind of things I'd like to hear from you. And I'd like to hear what else parents have done. And you can disguise your voice and not give me your real name. What's the most aggressive thing you as a parent have done for your kids? So, for instance, have you done their homework for them? Not just help them, not just monitor them, not just get them a tutor, but have you sat down and done their homework with them knowing that they're going to be graded on it? And even if they don't know how to do it, you do. And you can get them a good grade. Tell me, have you done that? 981-7200. Also, have you ever just done a project? Have you gotten out the glue gun and done the science project so that it looks perfect and it doesn't look like a 9-year-old did it? Have you done that? How about those college mission statements or whatever they're called? Have you ever really sat down? You might have helped your child write it and guided your child and given your child some ideas. But did you actually write it? Did you actually sit down and rewrite it so that it's more grammatical, a little more compelling? 981-7200. I'd like to hear from you. And we'll talk about this case up until the 7:30 point. We have our guest. And then at 8 o'clock, I will be taking your legal calls, as always. I'm a practicing lawyer. If you have a question about something you've seen in the news, you have a legal question about something or a family member, whether it's divorce or contract or a criminal, give me a call here at 8 o'clock and we'll try to answer it or get you some ideas on how to answer it. 981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show and watch for Chicago's very own Stories with Micah and Joe, Micah Martyr and Joe Donlin weeknights on WGN TV News at 9.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. We're talking about the university scandal, and I want your opinions. Thank you for calling, everyone. I'll try to get to everyone. 981-7200. Who's the most culpable in this piece? Is it the mastermind? Is it the parents? Is it the school for not monitoring? Is it the proctors? Hey, is it the coaches who knew about this and knew the kids weren't rowing a boat in their video? They just put them on the crew team to get them into Yale. 981-7200. And what's the most aggressive thing you've done for your kids that might have crossed the line? And just because you want to help your kids out and make sure they do well in school. Hi, Denise. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
To you, too.
I do think that this is always going on. I don't think this is a shock to anyone. But I think that what's different here is that the school didn't get the money. A private individuals did. And I think that someone found out. And I think that the school is just about, because you know, really, what's the bottom line of schooling anymore? It's money. It's how much can I pay? And so someone didn't pay the college, and I think they didn't have a building name. They didn't donate tons of money. And I really feel sincerely that that's what happened. None of us who have paid for our education have, you know, we paid for it by ourselves. We didn't get government help. We didn't get any of these other things. And I really think it's the schools at fault because they knew what was going on.
Well, and that's interesting. And I think a lot of people have that opinion. And it's interesting. And maybe I'm, you know, maybe even as a lawyer, I'm naive. It was such a planned out scheme. It was so blatant. It wasn't even just like, hey, you know, like, I know if you do this, maybe you can get an advantage here. This was just out and out. This is what the cost of it, you know, of getting in is.
You said the bottom line, the cost. And I think it's terribly wrong.
Well,
but
right.
I don't think this is news. I really don't. I think this has gone on forever.
And it was done, you know, in different ways. And I even know about college athletes and the money was paid for by an alumni to the family or maybe gave them a car or did something. And all of those things have been going on for years. And you know what the sad thing is? I mean, I'm a kid who went to state school and I'm a kid who put myself through school 100%.
Right.
I feel like the kids like me who came from families that couldn't afford college, let alone a private school, I feel like they're going to be discouraged and they're going to feel like not only can I not get loans to go to school, I can't get in because I've got all these rich people spending triple what tuition is just to get them in the door, you know?
Yeah,
and I hope that's not the case.
I don't think that that would be the case. I think that any of us that have worked, like you, who have worked very hard to get in, and our children have worked hard, I don't think that's going to be a discourager, because I think that we kind of know that the rich have privileges that no one else has. And I really think the bottom line is that the college is really honking mad.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the call, Denise. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much for your
show. I think you're voicing what a lot of people already think. Let's go to a caller from Chicago. Hi, welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Are you talking to Ed?
I'm talking to Ed. I didn't see your name.
Oh,
so it said
great.
Chicago, and I knew that was not your name.
Yeah, right. That's why I figured. Well, anyway, let me start by saying this. Number one, this scam that's been going on, I'm sure has been going on for many, many years at a lot more schools with a lot more individuals and a lot more creative ways to pay your way into the school of your choice. So that's number one. Number two, I don't think it's that big of a deal, to be honest with you.
Huh,
I mean, maybe it's
really?
Illegal, maybe they get in trouble, but at the end of the day, is it that big of a deal? I mean, it's one of those crimes that really doesn't harm anybody.
Ooh, really?
Right? Yeah, I agree.
Okay,
go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm going to give you an example. There was one parent who was the class plaintiff in one of the lawsuits, and she said her son had a 4.2, which means he had a perfect GPA but had taken advanced placement classes or advanced classes and got those extra bonus points. So he had a perfect thing. He had all this stuff going on, and he didn't get into one of those schools. Could he not be angry, and could the parents not be rightfully upset that someone who didn't even really care about what school, whose parents are worth millions of dollars and probably don't need to work anyway at some point in their lives, you know, gets into the school
I will say this to you. I will say this to you. At every top school, and I went to one of the top schools in the nation, maybe the world even, okay? You go to one of those schools, there are 1,000 or more students every admission year that have 4.0s and 30-somethings on their ACTs that don't get in. So if this kid, I had a 4.2, everybody feels their kid is the greatest. I mean, that's just, I think my kids are the greatest. That's human nature. But at the end of the day, are you going to tell me that a couple of kids that scam their way in, which I don't agree with, but I don't think it's that big of a deal, a couple of kids that scam their way in prevented this one kid with a 4.2, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's probably not. I'm 99.9% sure that he didn't get in for other reasons, and mainly because if he's trying to get into a top school, there's thousands of kids with those 30-something ACT, 1,600 SAT, and top grades.
And you know, and I hear what you're saying, and I see what you're saying. They probably got into a good school anyway, and this was an isolated incident, and it didn't affect that many people. But I guess I just think of the kid who, you know, sits at his desk. He's up all night doing his homework, you know, fretting about these things, and he feels like he just didn't get a fair shot. This was maybe...
Right, that was me.
Yeah.
But that was me back in the day, and I still don't begrudge anybody, because at the end of the day, I'm going to be blunt in a second. After I want to bring up another point, then I'm going to come back to this, which is this. When you asked about what have we done for our kids, for me, all of the above. Everything you've mentioned and more have I done for them. Homeworks, tests, filled out applications, all of the above. And I do it with them so they can see what a work looks like, whatever. They've done work on their own. I've done work with them. I've done work by myself for them, all of the above. That's what we do for our kids.
That's probably true.
Maybe I overdo it. But at the end of the day, let me get back to the point that we were just making, which is this. It's that profit motive. It's that money talks type of attitude that pushes a lot of us to be the best that we can be so that we can gain every advantage that we can. Not illegal advantage like these situations, but other things like living in the right neighborhood and sending my kid to the right school, which is why I live in the North Shore, because I grew up on the South Side, and I didn't want my kids to go to the high school that I went to.
I hear you.
It's a bad school, but it doesn't compare to the New Trier's and the Stevenson's.
Got it.
My kids go,
All right, I got it. And I'm gonna have to get to the other calls, but I really appreciate it. And on one hand, I'm with you on it, that it motivates you, says if I have money, then I'll do better in life. On the other hand, if you have money and you can cheat, is that the example that we're giving? It goes both ways. I love this conversation. All right, Connie. Hi, Connie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you, you know, I sent my kids to Catholic school, and I feel horrible about doing this, but the thing that I did for my kids, they would send my high schoolers home with word searches. Remember those?
No.
And I thought you just find the word and you circle the words, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. I took every one of those and I did them for them. And I tried to explain to my children why, but it's still wrong. Yeah. I don't care what you're saying. It's still inappropriate. And here I'm sending my kids to Catholic school, right?
Well, and horrible. I think all of you listeners who have weighed in, stick around and listen to this author, because she talks about how you have to let your kids fail. And she has a whole list in her book about you have to let someone deal with a pet dying, you have to deal with a failed test, a fired job, a plant that dies, that, you know, all of those things that are failures when you're a kid, those all make you a better adult. And then you're able to deal with problems that are real problems when you get older. And you know, again, Connie, I think you're in the majority, the vast majority of parents who help their kids in those ways, but it's in thin line, I guess, is where do we draw the line? Is this an example now of things that we shouldn't do? Thanks for the call, Connie. Right. Appreciate it. All right. I'm going to take a break now. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Julie Lithcott Hames, who wrote the fabulous book, How to Raise an Adult. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by and feed.
We're still talking about this shocking scandal, Operation Varsity Blues. It's called 50 people, including Hollywood stars, top CEOs, college coaches, test administrators were involved in the scheme, allegedly. 8 universities named in the indictment. The fallout is shattering. There's all kinds of class action lawsuits potentially costing billions of dollars to the players. And, you know, the question is, should we be in shock? Or given this recent epidemic of what we call helicopter parenting, and that is the people who parents who micromanage and steer and overprotect and hover and control their kids' lives and activities and, yes, school choices and admissions. Is this something that is a natural consequence of what's going on? And with us to talk about this phenomenon is New York Times bestseller of the book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kids for Success by Julie Lithcott Hames. Welcome to the show, Julie. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, Karen. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be in Chicagoland. I'm originally from Wisconsin, a couple hours north, although I'm a Californian now. So it's just great to hear your voice and to connect with the great people in Chicago.
You can feel the chill from there, I can tell.
I can.
Well, I'm looking at your resume. And okay, Bachelor of Arts from Stanford, Law degree from Harvard, Master's in Fine Arts. And I just think, like, how much would you have had to pay to buy those entrances? Did you ever think about that? No, just all kidding aside,
wow.
You know, are you surprised by this, given the book that you have and the talks that you have made about this very issue about parents pushing their kids into college?
The first thing I'm going to say is I'm a black woman. And so I know firsthand from having grown up with the rhetoric that most people think it's us, the black and brown people, who are, quote unquote, taking spots from white folks. That's the rhetoric I grew up with. And I think this week we all woke up to the fact that if anybody is stealing spots, it's the uber wealthy folks, the vast majority of whom are white, who are literally lying, cheating, and stealing to get their kids whatever they think is important by way of college. It is an extension of helicopter parenting. It is the ultimate extension. Parents who I'm calling now drone parents. The parent is the drone. They're picking up the package, which is the child, and delivering that package, the child, to the desired future, the right college. And, of course, then it'll be the right career. That child is an inanimate object. They are literally doing nothing to get themselves there. And if you can afford it, you know, and you don't have any ethics, fine, you're doing it. But let me tell you, it robs that young person of the sense that they're capable of doing anything. It damages their mental health. We may not want to think any compassionately toward these kids because they're so overprivileged and wealthy. But I'm here to tell you, no matter what your social class, when you are overmanaged like this, it harms your mental health. You literally do not have the skills to do for yourself, and your psyche, psychologically inside, you know, hey, I probably can't do anything without my parents attending my every move.
So, Julie, if you can, and just play this game with me, you know these parents. You've seen that you were the freshman dean at Stanford. You're a lawyer. You've practiced law. Get yourself in the head of these parents who have paid $500,000, $6 million, whatever it is, to get their kids in. What would their justification be? How would you say, Karen, this is why I did this?
Well, Karen, I would never do this, and you would never do this, but this is why they're doing it. These are parents with tremendous privilege, right? They can already buy their way into everything. We've learned that. So why do they feel the need to get their kid to a highly selective brand-name college? They're already setting their kid up for life. It can't be about, oh, I want to give them access to a better network of people. They've already got the network.
Right.
So why are they doing it? For their own ego. Their own ego. This is keeping up with the Joneses, Hollywood style. Keeping up with the Joneses, Silicon Valley style, whatever the community is. It's, I need that sticker for the back of my car with the right college on it so I can impress all my friends and all the drivers behind me with how amazing I am. I mean, my kid is, right? It's ego. It's purely ego. It's, I want to be able to brag at SoulCycle or Starbucks or on the golf course or wherever I hang out with the people I feel are judging me. I need to kind of ruffle my feathers and say, my child is at whatever the school is.
Interesting. You know, let's talk about helicopter parenting, because this phenomenon is interesting because it's not just one parent, two parents. Once in a while, this happens. It seems like there was a whole group of people that raised children all in the same way. And I watched it from all different sides. My friends raising children this way, where they couldn't even go on a vacation without their adult children calling them and asking them to how to turn on the dishwasher. I mean, things like that. They were not capable of doing things on their own. Can you give us some like societal bullet points, and you deal with this in your book, of how did we get to have helicopter parents?
How did we get here?
Yes.
Well, it all began in the 1980s when baby boomers were raising kids and things really began to change. And there's a beautiful irony because baby boomers were so concerned with having their own voice as young adults. They're the generation that turned out to rob their own kids of having a voice. Here's what happened. In the 80s, the play date was born by baby booming parents. Self-esteem movement was born, ribbons and trophies just for being on the team, not for being any good. Stranger danger was born, the concept of you might get abducted on any street corner, which is really a fallacy in terms of the actual statistics, but we've just let that theory bore itself into the minds of Americans. And a couple other things happened. We got a lot safer in cars with seatbelts and car seats, and then on bicycles with bike helmets. We became safer. We began hovering over play and on the sidelines of kids' activities and keeping an eye on them and grocery store. I mean, just parents were constantly managing, micromanaging, hovering over kids. And there's a short-term win to all of this. It looks like it helps, right? I prevented my child from falling off the swing at the playground because I was at the swing, right? I got my kid an A in the math class, which means they're going to get into a better math class next year. But long-term cost is the kid can't do anything for themselves because you've basically been their handler or their concierge. And it harms their mental health because you've basically told them, hey, kids, you're not capable of succeeding in the fourth grade. I have to do your homework for you. Hey, kid, you're never going to make it into college on your own merits. I have to lie, cheat, and steal on your behalf to get you in. So there's a long-term cost, even though there's a short-term gain. And I think we're only just beginning to appreciate the long-term cost.
Has this phenomenon diminished at all? Or are we seeing, was it on the upswing and now is it going down? Or do we still have parents who are doing the same thing?
Well, I got to tell you, my book came out close to 4 years ago. Wow. And in the beginning, so this would have been summer of 2015, spring of 2015, parents would be very defensive with me. And I came, I've had a wonderful set of visits to Chicagoland over the years. And actually, Chicago parents were the least defensive.
Oh.
Everywhere else, people were like, yeah, we know, we're just doing what we have to do to get our kid into the right college. The Chicago parents were saying, yep, we know this is a problem. What do we do about it? And I loved it. And so what I've seen change in the 4 years is a lot less defensive. Everybody knows someone in their town, in their school, in their own family who's been overparented. You can see the effects. You see those 20-somethings who are rebounding back home, who can't seem to kind of make a plan their day, get tasks accomplished, or, you know, have a job, talk with strangers, turn on the dishwasher, right? Make a simple meal. And everyone knows somebody, right? And so when we see the evidence, that makes us go, okay, I don't want my kid to end up like that. What do I need to do to dial back all of my intervention so my kid can start doing more for themselves? But I think until you realize the harm, the arms race is just continuing. And that's what this week's news is an indication of. Like, did anyone think this was happening? This literally, you know, people lying and cheating and stealing their way in. You know, this seems to be the nth degree of helicopter parenting. But if we don't turn this around in 5 years, I don't know what it'll be. I mean, it'll be parents paying off high school teachers and bribing coaches K through 12. I don't know. I mean, there's an ethical vacuum here. Parents thinking, I got to do whatever it takes to get my kid in, to get my kid to the future I want them to have. And of course, what we're missing is, no. Your job as a parent is to put yourself out of a job. One day, like it or not, you'll be dead, and your offspring has to be able to fend without you. And that's the ultimate reckoning. These kids who are overattended, overmanaged, overhelped will be bewildered when their parents are finally incapacitated or gone and cannot do everything for them any longer.
Can you hold with us a little bit, Julie? We're going to take a break, and I want to talk a little bit more specifically about the college situation. You're listening to Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of the book How to Raise an Adult. It's available on all fine bookstores, a New York Times bestseller, and we're going to talk a little bit more when we return. It's the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
But here's the good news. Contrary to what the college rankings racket would have us believe... You don't have to go to one of the biggest brand name schools to be happy and successful in life. Happy and successful people went to state school, went to a small college no one has heard of, went to community college, went to a college over here and flunked out. The evidence is in this room, is in our communities, that this is the truth. And if we could widen our blinders and be willing to look at a few more colleges, maybe remove our own egos from the equation, we could accept and embrace this truth and then realize it is hardly the end of the world if our kids don't go to one of those big brand name schools. And more importantly, if their childhood has not been lived according to a tyrannical checklist, then when they get to college, whichever one it is, well, they'll have gone there on their own volition, fueled by their own desire, capable and ready to thrive there.
We're listening to Julie Lithcott-Hames, the author of How to Raise an Adult. Oh, that was really stirring. That was awe-inspiring.
Thank you, Karen.
And of course,
I did that talk some time ago.
I know, but it's so timely. It was almost like you were prophetic in your words here. So let's talk a little bit specifically about, you know, and Texter just texted and said, how do these kids do, like the kids that maybe the parents did their homework and got the glue gun out and did their projects for them and got them into a school one way or the other? How do these kids do in college? Are they succeeding to what you've seen?
Well, based on what I've seen, kids who had that much help in high school require that much help in college. So if you've always pulled out the glue gun, when your kid has to pull out the glue gun in college, they really are quite worried about whether they're going to be able to complete the assignment as expected without your help. So maybe you're not flying out to use the glue gun, but you're on the phone with them, talking them through how to do it. If you've always edited their essays, not just provided feedback, hey, feedback is great, but when you've rewritten their essay for them, then they're afraid they can't turn in that paper in college without your bringing out your red pen and, telling them how to restructure it or to rewrite it. So effectively, the helicoptering doesn't stop. Once you've bought yourself this role of being your kid's handler or enabler or concierge, it's kind of a lifetime job because they are not capable. They don't feel capable either.
You talk in your book about a checklisted childhood. Can you tell our listeners what you mean by that?
Sure thing. Wherever you are, depending on where you are, it's slightly different, but it's sort of the right school. Now, where I live in Palo Alto, that starts in preschool. In some places, that concept of the right school doesn't start till high school or maybe even college. But it's that sense of I got to get my kids to get to start out at the right school, wherever that is. And then it's the right grades at the right school, the right classes. So it's not just any class. You've got to be in the best classes, getting all A's at the best school. And then that's just the start of it. Then it's the standardized tests and making sure that our kid, if we have the means, by the way, this is all a function of means, Karen. This is parents who are at least middle class, if not upper middle class and beyond, because you got to have means to cultivate your kid's childhood like this. So it's test prep, test prep, test prep, take the SAT or the ACT, maybe take them both, take them again, perfect your test. The test scores are a function of your ability to have studied for them and retaken them. They're basically a function of wealth. Okay, grades and scores, and then it's the accolades they're supposed to have to impress the admission dean, and all the awards you're supposed to have, and all the sports you're supposed to do, and all the activities, and all the leadership, and then the community service, which is usually the big joke at the end, like go to some third world country and say you helped out for a week. And when there are people suffering in your own hometown, you know, so that's the checklist of childhood. It's all the things the child must do in order to get into the quote unquote right college. And because it's not just doing those things, but doing them flawlessly, that overparenting is required. We're basically asking our kids to be more accomplished, more capable of the stuff their childhoods with more stuff than was ever asked of us, those of us who are, you know, at least probably 40 or older.
Now, your book seems to indicate that the kids are who go to the top schools, I mean, certainly you get into a good school, and certainly it's a wonderful thing to get an Ivy League education. But is there some study that shows, do these people actually make more money long term, maybe right out of law school, you're hired out of Harvard at $175,000 in a New York firm, whereas if you're at a lower tier school, you might be making $100,000 or maybe a little less, certainly at the beginning. But long term, is there some idea that kids that go to these schools are more earn more income?
There is no evidence of that. And in fact, there's evidence that if you're a smart, hardworking person who was in the running to be admitted to one of those places, but you didn't go there, you went somewhere else, your income 20 years later was no different from the kids who did go to those elite brand places. The research boils down to it's the kid, not the school. It's who you are and how you behave when you show up at college, not the brand name of the college. That determines whether you're going to be successful. You made an interesting point that you alluded to lawyers making money out of grad school. Choosing a grad school is really different than choosing a college. When you're going to grad school, you do want to try to attend one of the top schools in your field. This is often not brand name as much as just the ranking of their quality, because those employers, whether it's an investment bank or a law firm, They want to know you went to one of the top grad schools, because that's where, you know, they perceive the best education is. Here's proof that you don't have to go to a top college to go to a top law school. The Harvard Law School class of 2016, I looked at them for the book I was writing, How to Raise an Adult. 540 students in the class of 2016 at Harvard Law, they came from 171 different colleges. Most of us can't name 30 colleges, let alone 171, but Harvard Law School knows, hey, there's excellence to be had at all of these colleges that we just recruited students from. And my point is, if 171 colleges are good enough for Harvard Law School, can't they be good enough for you?
Absolutely. We only have a couple minutes left, but I in your book, you talk about their Harvard grant study, which was a study that was done. And let's just boil it down. You kind of address two different findings that were very telling on how to raise your kids to be good kids in the long run. Can you tell our listeners quickly about those things?
Yeah. So this is a study, but one of the longest studies of humans ever conducted through the decades of the lives of these humans they studied. And one key finding was that the people who were professionally successful in life turned out to have done chores as a kid or had a part-time job in high school, because chores or part-time job in high school builds a work ethic, teaches a kid, roll up your sleeve, be useful, pitch in, don't wait to be served, ask how can I contribute my effort to make the situation better. Another finding from that study showed that happiness in life equals loving relationships with other humans. The more we have love in our lives, the happier we will be. So our kids have to be loved unconditionally at home, not as a function of their GPA or their test scores, but simply love for who they are, so that they can love themselves and then go out into the world and give and receive love. right now our kids feel conditionally loved, loved if they're doing well. We act as if we want them to be someone else. We have to love the actual kid we've got and take an interest in helping them get stronger at what they're good at, rather than trying to make them into the child we wish they'd be if only they were more perfect or only more like the child we had in our dreams.
If you have just a couple of quick takeaways for parents who are out there, yeah, who may be guilty of some of the stuff that we're talking, yeah, about, how is it that, you know, give us some good bromides for, yeah, for the future here?
Yeah. Let me say this, Karen. I was a helicopter parent. I am a helicopter parent. Working with other people's kids at the college level helped me see what I was doing at home to my own. So whatever, I may sound brash here to your listeners, but I'm coming from a place of I totally own it, that I'm in it and I get it. The three things you can stop doing tomorrow: stop saying we if you mean your kid. We're on the soccer team. No, you're not. We have a midterm tomorrow. No, you don't. You've had algebra. It's their turn. Number two, stop arguing with all the authority figures in their lives. Teachers, principals, heads of school, coaches, referees, umpires are all under assault by us parents who think we have to argue every single point. Instead, teach your kid to advocate for themselves to authority figures with respect. That's a skill they need to learn. Number three, stop doing their homework. Nobody in Chicagoland, I'm sure, but nearby, other people are doing their kids' homework to try to get them the advantage, and it's unethical, and teachers don't know what kids know anymore, and the kid thinks they're incompetent because you're doing their work. Those are three things you can stop doing tomorrow or, you know, next week if you want to take a week to just sort of get right with it.
That's right. That's right. Julie, thank you so much for joining us. I know I'm going to call upon you again to come in, and if you're ever in Chicago, you're going to come by the studio, and we're going to have a lively conversation. Julie Lithcott-Hames, the author of a book you have to read, whether you're hiring millennials or you're raising a millennial still or you're raising children, yeah, now, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success, available at all bookstores, Amazon, etc. Thank you, Julie, for joining us.
Karen, thank you for having me.
Okay.
Always great to be with the great folks in Chicago. Bye.
Okay, take care. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
You can put away your tissues, because here's the answer to your legal issues. 30 years experience in this town. Karen Conti wears the legal crown, and it's about to go down.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. She was a great guest. And, you know, it's just, it's interesting that I do get calls from people and asking me to help people find jobs and all of that. But I've had some interesting calls of parents who have been helicopter call-in parents. I had one parent, and I'm not diminishing or making someone to try to feel bad about it, but they called in and they said their daughter, who was about 28 years old, had a full-time job. I won't say where she worked. And she got a performance review that was really bad, and the daughter wanted to sue the employer. And so I said to the mom, I said, well, why don't you have her call me? I said, doesn't sound like that's the answer to the question. You know, suing someone for a bad performance review is not a good idea. I mean, what are you going to gain by that? And the mother would not let me talk to the daughter and wanted to relay the message to her. And I said, the only way I can help your daughter, ma'am, is to talk to her. And she goes, well, she's too busy, and I want to do this for her. And I just thought, wow, this woman is, you know, this young lady is in for a world of hurt that she not only is not dealing with the performance review directly with her employer, which is what you should do. And you should say, why are you giving me one? Or I disagree with it, or whatever it is that you want to defend yourself in the workplace. But you're 28 years old and your mom is calling for you and not allowing you to even speak to the lawyer who's nice enough to maybe give you some advice. So I do get a lot of that. And it kind of makes you angry a little bit because you just feel like there's a child, an adult child, who is really going to be harmed in the long run if they're not learning to defend themselves, just as Julie, the author, said. But anyway, and thank you for all your calls and texts. You're very engaged in that conversation. This is the time where you can call in with your legal questions. I'm a practicing lawyer, and I can hopefully give you an answer or maybe give you somewhat of an answer or steer you in the right direction on any legal topic you might have or something maybe that has puzzled you that you hear in the news. I'm happy to try to weigh in. 981-7200-312, 981-7200, or you can text. If for some reason reason you don't get through or you don't want to talk on the radio, you want to talk privately, call my office number. I'm always happy to discuss it with you. 312-332-7800. And put that in your phone because you never know when you might need a lawyer or a friend of yours might need a lawyer. It doesn't always happen that you need one, but when you do, it usually has some time urgency is what happens. 312-332-7800. And even better is my email address, because if I need to refer you to an article or maybe refer you to a website or to another lawyer, I can do it very quickly via email. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti. And over the years, I just have to say, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging on this, but I've referred a lot of people to some very good lawyers. I know people who do work in different practice areas in different parts of the suburbs in the city, and I don't always know someone in your area. A lot of people ask me for out-of-state lawyers, and I don't always know out-of-state lawyers, but I can refer you to somebody who I trust, who I know is going to do a good job, who might be suited to your lawsuit. I had someone call in with a case that had to do with not being paid correctly under the employment laws. The person thought, hey, this doesn't seem right. It wasn't right. And I got that person referred to a class action lawyer, and a class action lawsuit is now being brought on a national basis based upon the violation of the, and it involves a lot of money and a lot of people who are wrong by the employer's violation of the law. So I've had some really good success stories, and not so much that the cases that I can say that I've taken, although I've had a lot of those. But I just finding you the right lawyer, finding you the right person, getting you to a person who's not on a park bench or on the yellow page book, or, you know, who shows up first in the Google search. Those aren't always the best lawyers around. Those, some of the lawyers who are really good don't come up in the Google searches right away. So again, 312-332-7800 or WGN@askkarenconti.com. Phone lines are open. So meanwhile, I'm going to talk about a couple of emails and texts that I have gotten this week that I thought were interesting. I had Natalie from Morris, Illinois, send me an email, and she said that she was a bookkeeper for a small company where the owner is getting a divorce. And she said that she was just served with a subpoena for a deposition. She wanted to know what to do. Does she need a lawyer? And should she talk to her boss about it? So a deposition is a situation where there's litigation going on, meaning people are suing each other. And one of the parties wants a person to sit down and answer questions under oath with a court reporter there. And the purpose of it is to prepare for trial, to get evidence against one party or another, or try to get information that is helpful to the trial or the settlement of the case. So as a bookkeeper in a small company, the owner is getting a divorce. So perhaps the wife's lawyer, I think the owner was a male, the wife's lawyer probably thought the bookkeeper may know about maybe business expenses that weren't really business expenses, or maybe there was a concern that there was a cooking of the books and that the income should be more than it is. I'm just guessing, but who knows? They have a right to depose you. There's nothing improper about that. You don't need an attorney at all, and you will show up, and if they ask you to bring documents, you'll bring the documents, and you will answer all the questions as truthfully as you possibly can under oath, knowing that it's all going to be recorded. You're sworn in to tell the truth, and it shouldn't be a big problem because you're going to be telling the truth, and it's not something you need to study for or memorize anything. If there's questions that they want you to answer, they usually will give you documents to review, and it should be something that you really shouldn't worry about, although it is kind of nerve-wracking. It can go for 3 hours in a state court. That's the limit in a state court case. So it's a long day, and it's something that you could talk to your boss about. You don't have to, but don't let your boss tell you what to say, because you're going to tell the truth because you're sworn to tell the truth, and that's the right thing to do. So that was Natalie and Morris. 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open. I had a call from Anna from Wakanda, who had, I referred her to a lawyer for a matter, and she emailed me back and called me back and said, you know, I want to know why lawyers decide to take cases or not take cases, because she had talked to my referral and the lawyer did not want to take the case. And just generally speaking, lawyers, it depends on the kind of case, but normally lawyers will not take a case unless they think that they can help the person for a reasonable price. And that's not all lawyers, because there are some who may not feel that way. But for instance, I get a call from someone who is owed $500 because they didn't, someone took a loan out and didn't pay them back. Well, I wouldn't take that case because it would cost much, much, much more in legal fees to collect that money than it would that's at stake. And even if the client said, well, I want to bring it anyway and I want to teach him a lesson, you know, I just don't think it's right to spend someone's money without getting a good result. So a lot of lawyers won't take a case in that regard. Lawyers who take personal injury cases or medical malpractice cases want to make sure that the case has a lot of merit, because they do a lot of work on a contingent basis, which means they don't get paid until they settle the case or until they go to trial. So they're not going to take something that might have problems. Maybe they perceive that there's problems collecting from the third party, or maybe there's problems with liability, or, you know, if someone died of some procedure, maybe the person was a smoker and maybe would have died anyway, and so there's not a lot of damages. And it sounds kind of cold and hard, but lawyers have to make a living, and lawyers look at cases from a different way than you would. If you've been wronged, that's important to you and you want to be recompensed for that. But lawyers look at it as, is this a practical case for me to take where I can make the client money or make the client whole and still make money yourself without any issues? So that's my best answer, is that you basically, as a lawyer, look at the case from the perspective of, how is this going to go and is this going to be a success for both parties? Give us a call here. Phone lines are open. You're awful quiet. Call me at 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show, and it's WGN.
She's legally blonde and brilliant. Karen Conti, attorney at law, is taking your legal questions right now. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200.
Now's your chance to get your calls in. Our lines are open, 981-7200. Any legal topic you have? Do you have a family law issue, a breach of contract? Do you have an issue regarding personal injury? Do you need a lawyer in some area and you want to kind of don't know what area that is? Let me do my best to try to give you an answer. 981-7200, 981-7200. I got a nice text from someone who said, Karen Conti, I love Karen Conti. She really does answer your emails when you have questions. I do. I answer your emails. And you can always email me at my office, and I try to give you an answer. I try to either answer you or give you to someone who might know the answer, and that's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. So give us a call here. I have a text from Carla in Downers Grove. I was injured in a car accident. I'm trying to settle with the insurance carrier. How do I know how much my case is worth? My friend had a similar injury while she was working, and I'm surprised at how little her settlement was for. Well, you know, that's a hard question, because when you get into an accident and you have injuries, it's probably, if you have just insignificant injuries, maybe you want to settle that on your own. But if you have anything significant at all that requires physical therapy or ongoing treatment, you really do want to hire a personal injury lawyer. And even though you're going to give that lawyer a percentage of your recovery, you're going to make enough more by having that lawyer as your advocate than if you settled it on your own. Insurance companies know when they have you on their own. They start talking to you right away. They get you to say you're feeling okay. They record your conversations. They want to settle for as little as possible. So if you're injured at all, of any significance, I would not speak with an insurance company when they call. You have no obligation to do it. I would call a lawyer that you trust, or if you don't know a personal injury lawyer, call me. I don't do this kind of work. I don't sue people in personal injury cases or workers' comp or any of that stuff, but I know people who are very good at what they do and can refer you to the right person. So the answer is, you know, there's a rule of thumb that you should be entitled to three times what your medical expenses are. But that is just a rule of thumb that doesn't always apply. You know, so if your medical bills are $2,000, should your settlement be $6,000? But what if you have permanent injury? What if you have an injury that is something that makes you, you know, put you in a situation where you can't do your job on a long-term basis, or you're going to have ongoing medical issues? Well, that's something a lawyer needs to assess. And lawyers know from experience who do this kind of work how much a case is really worth, and they can give you an estimate and they can try to shoot for that in their negotiations. And sometimes it's necessary to bring a lawsuit, and then sometimes the insurance companies will come to the table and settle for a higher amount. One of the things that Carla said in her text was that she had a friend who had a workers' comp injury, and she was surprised at how little that recovery was. Well, workers' comp is very different than personal injury. If you're injured on the job, the case goes to what we call the Industrial Commission, which is a place where it sounds like a factory, but it's not. It's a special court where all these cases get heard. And in exchange for, if you get work hurt on the job at work while you're doing your job, you are entitled most of the time to compensation. It doesn't matter if you tripped on your shoelaces. It doesn't matter if it was your fault, for the most part. In exchange for that liability advantage, you get reduced damages. So you don't get every single last penny like you might in a personal injury case. So workers' comp has a whole different schematic when it comes to how much you get for an injury. In fact, there's a whole book that you look at and how those things are assessed. And they're largely related to how much you earn and how much you are damaged. In fact, how you're impacted in doing your job. So there's a whole different way of calculating what those damages might be. So don't talk to your lady who's a workers' comp, has a workers' comp case, because that's definitely not the same thing. 981-7200, 981-7200. So tell me what your areas of expertise is. Oh, well, thank you, 630. Texter. I have in the past done a lot of different things. I've done criminal law. I've done employment law. I've done insurance coverage. I've done business litigation. And right now in my career, I do mostly family law. Family law is a nice way of saying divorce law. I get people divorced. I handle child support. I handle custody. We don't call it custody anymore, parenting time. We handle prenuptial agreements, ongoing child support issues, and those types of things. That's mainly what I do. So those are the cases that I do take. I do take them in Chicago. I take them in the collar counties. And I have a staff that are really competent lawyers who handle these cases with me. So yeah, that's what I do. Now, and I know a little bit about some of these things, you know, so I can talk about them because I've handled them. Let's go to 224 area code. Okay, Karen, what is the length of time you have to file an injury if you were rear-ended and are still feeling the effects of whiplash in your neck? Sorry to hear that you were in a car accident. It's 2 years from the date of the accident. Negligence, which is what we're talking about, car accidents are negligence. It's a 2-year statute of limitations, and that's the date of the accident. So, and it's etched in stone. So it's not one of these things where if you're a couple days late, it's okay. You have to file it before that deadline. And so if you have an issue like that, don't wait till the end, because some lawyers won't file it on the end, you know, at the end of the statute of limitations. They need to do some research. They need to do some investigation. They need to get the police report and the medical records. So don't wait. If you have any idea that you have ongoing injuries, and listen, whiplash, I mean, I know there's jokes about, you know, pain in the neck and people faking injuries, but whiplash is real. If anyone is out there who thinks it isn't, I mean, you can feel perfectly fine on the date of the accident, and the next day and the days following, you can have serious problems in your neck and your back, and escalating, you know, later even than the next day. So make sure that you protect yourself and you hire a lawyer. And if you need a referral, I'm always the one to make sure. And I have Margaret in Bridgeport, who says, Karen always will steer you in the right direction. Oh, very nice. Thank you, Margaret. I try to. And, you know, some lawyers handle big personal injury cases, they only handle the cases where a plane crashes in Ethiopia, or big cases where there's medical malpractice and someone dies. And I say big cases, those are big damage cases. But then there are lawyers who handle slip and falls in the Walmart, and they handle rear enders, and they handle people who slip in, at a party, you know, or on the stairs. So those are the smaller cases. But the lawyers that do those kind of cases handle them in bulk. And I know lawyers on both sides who do this kind of work and who are best able to handle these types of things. Let's see. When you speak of a lawyer you can trust, I wonder what that can infer. Can a lawyer get paid off easily? I enjoy your show immensely. Thank you. Can you speak to a lawyer? I wonder if trust that you can infer. What can that infer? Well, the people that I refer people to are lawyers who I've either dealt with in a case on the same side, on the case against each other, or someone I've met and referred business to and they've been successful. I have a lawyer who does some personal injury work, a specific kind of personal injury work, and I had a caller who I didn't really think had a good claim. And I said, can you just talk to this guy? He's got a really horrible situation, but I just don't know that it really has any legal basis. And this gentleman, the attorney that I sent him to, found a really good legal basis that I wasn't aware of and brought the suit, and within a very short period of time got a huge seven figure settlement that was just completely unexpected by everybody. But again, it was because I trusted this lawyer. I knew this lawyer was creative. I've seen him get really good results on things that I don't think would be a good case, but how do I know? Because that's not my area of expertise. So I entrusted that lawyer to talk to the WGN listener, and it was just a fabulous success. And despite the tragedy that occurred to this person, this client, he was extremely happy and extremely pleased that he got that recovery. Do we need to take a break? Take a break now? Okay. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will be taking more of your calls, 981-7200. You're awful quiet. Call me. I'm here, 981-7200, or text to 981-7200. You're listening to WGN. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. We're taking your calls, 981-7200. Kind of nasty. Text. This is a lawyer marketing show. You refer calls to your network and refer people. It's all about money. What a philanthropic show you run. Oh, so not nice. So not nice. I just want to let you know that when you call my office or when you email me, I get back to you. And it's not about making money. If I make money, I make money. I don't do it to make money. I help people. I help seniors. I help battered women. I help people who don't know where to turn. I try to find the right lawyer. I spend my own time doing this. I spend hundreds of hours a year doing it. I consider it a public service. I consider it my pleasure to do it. So not fair. But anyway, texters sometimes are not nice. Okay. Dave, you have a legal question. Welcome to the show. Hi, Dave.
Thanks for taking my call. You
sure.
Hear me?
Yes. I hear you loud and clear.
Thank you. I was trying to follow up on something that you'd mentioned before. This isn't specific to me or anyone I know. Just more about how depositions work in general. What are the rules? How do I find out someone wants to depose me? Do I have the option to refuse? Does it vary depending on if it's a civilian, a civil case, or a criminal case? Am I facing like contempt of court, or is there a subpoena authority that would require me
to
appear?
Good questions.
So I'm curious to hear about more of the ins and outs of what's required, how the rules go with that to start, and what options does the, for lack of a better term, the target to be deposed, what options do they have to decline or
Sure. Maybe wise,
depending on what they maybe need to say to have representation.
Sure. The deponent is the name. Sure. Good questions, Dave. If you receive a subpoena for a deposition or for anything, maybe you receive a subpoena for production of documents, maybe you receive a subpoena to come to court, this is something you do not ignore. A subpoena, if it's if it's issued appropriately and it's not a scam or it's not something that some, you know, if it's a legitimate subpoena, which you're going to assume it is, you are required to do what that document says. And if the document says you are to appear for your deposition at 2 o'clock on March 19th, then that's what you need to do. Now, if you receive it and you can't do it because you have a work commitment, you can call up the lawyer that sent it and say, can we do it on a different day? This isn't convenient. Most lawyers would continue that or accommodate you. Okay. There is no option if you're subpoenaed. And if you don't honor a subpoena, the judge can issue what we call a bench warrant, which means they can go and pick you up and take you to court or take you to the deposition. You do not want to do that. Now, not judges may not do that the first time you don't show up. The judges may say, well, call this person, get him in here. And if you can't get him in here, then I'll take drastic measures. But you are required to honor a subpoena for a deposition and to go there. Generally speaking, you don't need a lawyer. If you feel like you do, you can hire a lawyer to kind of guide you through the deposition, and you're entitled to have a lawyer present. But largely, if you're not involved in the case and you're not a party and you don't have any money at stake, and you're a truth teller, you're going to just go there and tell the truth. Like I said in my prior telephone call with a client, with a potential client, they were talking about, you know, there's rules about depositions. You are entitled to a lawyer there. The parties can be present. The court reporter takes down everything you say. You're entitled to see the transcript. In a state case, the maximum time allowed is 3 hours. So there's all kinds of rules about it. But if you're curious at all, and if you have been subpoenaed for a deposition and you want to know what your rights are, you know, you can reach out and I can either tell you myself if I have more facts about what it is that you're being deposed for. And I'll probably advise you one way or the other. Do you need a lawyer? Do you feel like you need a lawyer? Is that something that that I think would be good for you? I hope that answers your question, Dave. Thank you. All right. Let us go to Bob. Hi, Bob. Welcome to WGN. You have a question about medical malpractice. Hi, Bob. I don't know if you're there. Let's see. Hi, Bob.
Can you hear me?
I can. Hi, Bob.
Yes. Okay. I was on lithium for 13 years, and last June, my hand started shaking. I called my psychiatrist, and he never returned my calls. I called again. He never returned my calls. So I went off the lithium. To make a long story short, I went for my regular appointment a month or two later, and he said, just keep the lithium. You might get a little depressed. So I stayed off the lithium. I kept the lithium pills. And about 3 weeks later, I went into a severe depression. I tried taking the lithium, and I took some extra lithium, and I wound up with lithium poisoning in the emergency room at St. Alexis Hospital. I was there 6 days. My lithium level went to 1.8. If it would have gone to 2, I would have died. I had to go to rehab 2 weeks, and then I was in Gottlieb Hospital, the psych, for 2 weeks. And the new psychiatrist put me on a new antidepressant.
Okay.
I got out in September 1st.
Okay.
And I was totally afraid to go out. My question is, I have a girl coming 4 times a week. Who takes me shopping in that, do I have grounds for a medical malpractice suit?
Okay. Thank you. And I'm sorry to hear about those facts. I can't tell you just from what you told me whether or not you have a viable case. I will tell you this. If you took your medicine differently than was prescribed, then that would be a difficult case. I understand why you did that, but it could be that a defense would be, hey, you didn't take it the way it was prescribed. That's number one. Number two, the lawyers that handle these cases, they're very expensive to handle, Bob, because you have to hire lawyers to review all of the documents, and you have to have doctors testify, and they're very expensive. Doctors are more expensive than lawyers. So it has to be a lot of damage, meaning, you know, death, serious ongoing disability. The fact that you were in the hospital for 6 days is horrific, and it's terrible, but that may not be enough of a damage case for a lawyer to take. However, I want you to do this. Send me an email. I will refer you to somebody who will look this over. They will give you a good assessment of it one way or the other. They will tell you maybe it was malpractice, but maybe there's just not enough damage here, Bob. But you'll get a straight answer, okay? So I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to say my email address, and if not, my producer will give that to you. Okay, Bob?
Okay, thank you.
All right, all right. Good luck to you. And I'm going to give out that email address, WGN@AskKarenConti.com, 312-332-7800. Hi, Marlene. Welcome to the show. You have a question.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
It's a great show. I enjoy it always.
Thank you.
I just want to ask a general question. At a job, you were off of work because of illness, and they told you to fill out the short-term disability form, and the doctors filled it out the best they could, and then you were able to return to work, so you brought in the letter you could return to work, and they called 2 hours later and said, well, we don't like the short-term disability, we're denying it, so you're no longer employed here. So the question is, they said that could we appeal this or
okay.
And they didn't give an answer.
Okay, Marlene. Yeah, Marlene, I just want to know, so were you actually off and you were receiving it, or you applied for it while you were out and then they denied it altogether?
Yes, I applied during being off of work.
Okay. Generally speaking, insurance policies have a procedure by which you can appeal. You have to read your policy very carefully, and you may not even have a copy of that policy. So you're going to have to ask your employer as quickly as you can for a copy of the policy. You're going to look at the table of contents and find the place that says appeal, appeals of decisions. Usually there's a very short time period by which you file that appeal. And generally what you put in that appeal is in writing, and you say, you put in the doctor's notes and the medical records that would argue for disability. You put it together as quickly as you can with as much meat on it as you can, and you can take an appeal. Generally speaking, appeals are very difficult with insurance companies. If they've denied the claim, your chances of winning that are not great, but you can do it on your own, and there's really no harm to doing it as long as you make sure that you do it as thoroughly as you possibly can, and it's probably not worth it to hire a lawyer to do that. If it's a long-term disability, if that's what your issue is, and that might be something that you could get for 10 years, at that point, you might want to hire a lawyer who does insurance coverage and insurance appeals, because that could be worth quite a bit of money. Okay? And I got to run. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's not that case, but the thing is, when asked about an appeal, they didn't even answer.
Yeah, well, no, they're not going to, because they're not going to tell you what your rights are. Insurance companies will make you go through the hoops, so you're going to have to find out on your own.
This is the actual place of employment.
Yeah, okay, I've got to run, but good luck. And if you want a referral to a lawyer who does this kind of work, if it reaches that point, I'd be certainly happy to give you that information. So here's what I'm going to do. You call me here if you have other questions. If not, if I don't have any callers, I'm going to do a little Irish quiz. And there's valuable prize in it. So how about the third caller at 981-7200? It's about green, the color green. And it's a fun little quiz. It's a general information quiz. 981-7200. You'll talk to my producer and get on the air, and we'll have some fun with it. If you have questions, 981-7200, or text to that number. You're listening to WGN. Thank you for all your calls. There were a couple that I didn't get to that I want to quickly answer. Overtime law. What's the general overtime law? The overtime law says that if you work over 40 hours in a work week, you are entitled to 1.5 times your regular pay. That's the general rule. There's a federal law, there's a state law, but that's the essence of the overtime law. Anything over 40 hours, the employer has to pay you 1.5 times. Someone texted in and asked me, do I have lawyers in Michigan to whom I can refer you? And the answer is I do, actually, and not in all counties and all places, but I have a really good referral source in the Detroit area and in the Grand Rapids area who can usually find me someone in Michigan if I don't know somebody, in your particular county. Texter says, wife and I separated. There was a car that we bought during the marriage. Does she have to buy me out? And the answer is yes. Anything that was purchased during the marriage, you own probably roughly half of it. So you would look at the value of the car minus whatever is owed on it, and she would technically owe you 50% of that if she's going to keep it. If not, you get it sold and you split the proceeds, and that's generally how it works. If there are other assets in the divorce, that's how those are handled as well. But thank you very much for all your calls and all your texts, and now we're going to play a fun green little quiz, and we have Mike. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hold on. I'll get off the speaker.
Okay, get off the speaker. All right.
Oh, yeah, because that makes it sound like an echo. So
yeah, okay.
There you go.
Do you feel really lucky tonight, like the luck of the Irish?
Well, I'm my parents both came from Ireland, and so they call me Generation Irish. I could have been born there or here, but
yeah.
I was born here.
I think they say that between 36 and 38 million Americans are of Irish heritage, and that's second only to Germans. So it's we got a lot of Irish people here, descended from people from Ireland. Okay, here we go. So this little quiz that we're going to play, I think the rule is going to be if you get 8 correct by the time we are finished, you will get the very valuable Karen Conti show hat. Oh my gosh! And yeah, like all that disappointment, all in one breath. I could hear it. But anyway, it's the theme of the quiz is green. Okay,
right.
Green, the color green. All right, here we go. What is the 1960s TV show featuring Eddie Albert and Ava Gabor?
Green Acres is the place to be.
He gets an extra point, Jerry. Jerry's keeping score. My husband's keeping score. But he gets an extra point for the singing. Okay. All right, here we go. What Friends character, that's a television show, Friends, had the last name Green?
Oh, that was the one that ran out on her wedding.
Yes?
To start the show.
Yes?
She's Green. And
yes?
Her dad is Mr. Green. And he got in. He was always getting into fights with Russ.
Okay. Do you know the name of the actress? Either the name of the actress or the character on the show?
Aniston.
Jennifer Aniston. That's correct. And she
was right.
Rachel Green.
Yep.
Very good.
Two for two.
All right. What famous Canadian Green was married very briefly to Drew Barrymore?
Wasn't Shelley Green?
No, it wasn't Shelley Green.
I'm trying to think, because she's young.
She is
She's younger than me. I remember bringing my 6-year-old to see her first movie, The Alien.
Ah. Well,
I think it was 83 or something.
So do you know the Canadian actor who she was married to?
I don't know.
His name was Tom Green. Tom Green. Okay.
Right. He was just on the show Celebrity whatever, you know, the house.
All right.
I forget what it was.
I don't know. But, yeah. I'm not real familiar with him. Okay, let's go. 1941 Best Picture was a film adaptation of a Richard Llewellyn novel. What was the name of the movie?
The Corn is Green?
No, I'll give you a hint. The first word is how. Does that ring a bell? 1941 Best Picture was a film adaptation of a Richard Llewellyn novel. And I'll give you another clue. How green.
How green's the corn?
How green was my valley? We're not going to give you credit for that. All right, Jerry.
That was a Scottish film.
Yeah? Okay.
Yes.
All right. What famous comic?
I remember it, but now I'm at lost.
That's okay.
You still
have a chance to win. All right.
All right.
What famous comic book character was a newspaper publisher who battled crime with his Asian valet / martial arts expert?
Oh, that was the Green Hornet.
That is correct. Green Hornet. And what was the name of his sidekick? You get an extra point for that.
Oh, Top Job.
Wasn't it? No.
It was. Top Job was the driver, and he had a hat that he threw with a metal cutter in it.
Wasn't it Kato?
Oh, yeah, it was Kato. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm thinking of another
you were confusing
superhero's
me.
Partner.
What famous children's character sang It's Not Easy Being Green?
Oh, that was Kermit.
That's right. What country's flag, this is a hard one, consists of a simple green field with no other characteristics on it?
Kermit.
What country's flag has a simple, it's just all green, nothing else on it?
I'm trying to think now.
This is a real hard one. You may not get this one.
Iceland?
No, I'm so sorry. It's Libya.
Oh, Libya.
Okay.
Oh.
What does the green flag in auto racing symbolize?
It means proceed, go.
Well, it does, but it also, it's more specifically, it means the pits are open.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. Okay. All right.
All right. Sorry. Jerry, what's the score here? How's Mike doing? Four correct with a point for singing and... Okay, here we go.
Right.
Name what soulful singing hits? What soulful singer has hits, including Let's Stay Together and How Can You Mend a Broken Heart?
Oh,
Let's Stay Together is probably his best-known song.
Yeah, I know. I know who it is, and I can hear him. He's a big, tall, kind of heavy-set man.
Yep.
Something Green.
It's Something Green.
I know.
Right.
I can picture him.
Al Green.
Yeah.
All right. What 1999 movie was set on death row in a southern prison in 1935?
Green Mile?
That's correct. What shade of green was mentioned in The Wizard of Oz?
Emerald?
That's correct. What two primary colors can be mixed together to make the color green?
Red and yellow?
Try again. What two colors can be mixed together to make the color green?
Yellow and blue.
That is correct. And let's do one more, and you're going to win. But I just want to see if you know this one. What is the title of the tale of the red-haired orphan written by L.M. Montgomery? It was a classic book.
What is the title?
Yeah, it was a classic book. It was a little red-haired orphan, and the book was written by L.M. Montgomery.
Little Orphan Annie?
I'm so sorry. It is Anne of Green Gables.
Oh, Anne of Green Gables.
But you did a great job. You did a great job, and I want to thank you for participating in our little green quiz. I'm going to put you on hold, and the producer's going to get your address, and you're going to get a Karen Conti Show hat. Thank you again.
Oh, boy. I love that.
Yeah, it's very valuable. Take care.
Oh, I'm sure there's not going to be a lot out there.
No, you're right. It might be a collector's item someday. You never know. All right, here we go. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and say goodbye. But don't forget, the Rick Hogan Show is next. And coming up, the news stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.